to make hand gestures, and I forget this is a radio and you can't see them.
I do that too.
The Jogcast, cheaper than 139,000 cups of coffee, with James Bamber, Therese Campbell, Fiona Healy, Monique Henson, Max Potter, Anna Scaife, and Charlie Walker. The Jogcast, April 2016, Extra Edition. Hello everyone, and welcome back to the Jogcast. I'm Charlie, and I'm here in our mysteriously clean studio with Therese and Fiona.
Hello.
Hi Charlie.
It's nice, isn't it?
It's lovely. Nice. Someone has done a really nice job putting all the postcards up on the wall. It works really well.
They're very nice. That's gorgeous.
And we've got some nice photos up here as well of Jogcast Live.
Yes, they're lovely. There we all are under the Lovell telescope.
Oh, that's pretty picture.
And we had some great fun, but I don't think we can do another one for 5 or 10 years.
10 years.
That's
somebody else's responsibility.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
We'll get some emails saying, how did you do it? Can you help us?
Yeah, maybe they'll invite us back.
Poor people. Okay. But back to the present day, we're back onto our regular schedule. So this is our second episode this month. I know people have been missing the extra episodes, and so it's good to be back. And in the show this time, Max interviews Dr. Ivascan Jimenez-Serra about astrochemistry, and Anna Scaife answers your astronomical questions.
But first, before all of that, Monique interviews Professor Richard Batty about Superclass, a week-lensing deep-field survey in this month's JodBite.
Hi, I'm here with Professor Richard Batty from the University of Manchester. Hello.
Hello.
And actually just here today to talk about your work on a project called Superclass. Would you be able to start out talking a little bit about what that's about?
So Superclass is an eMerlin legacy program, and it's an acronym. It stands for Supercluster Assisted Shear Survey. And the objective is to explore a new technique called radio weak lensing. So weak lensing is something that's been done for quite some time in the optical wave band, but it's not really been done before in the radio band. So what we'll do is we'll observe around 1 square degree of the sky using eMerlin, and eMerlin has very high resolution. And we hope to find around 5 to 10,000 galaxies in that region and use them to measure this property called weak lensing.
Okay, and so you're looking at, you said, superclusters. So what is a supercluster?
So a supercluster is an agglomeration of galaxy clusters. So a galaxy cluster is a cluster of galaxies, and a supercluster is a cluster of galaxy clusters. It's a region of space which is largely, you know, massively overdense, and that is the reason why we've chosen it, is because that will mean that the weak lensing signal will be larger than average. If we just picked an ordinary patch of the sky that we didn't know there was a supercluster there, then the signal we were looking for would be much weaker.
So it should be easier to spot it in this region.
It should be, hopefully anyway. So we know that there are at least 5 galaxy clusters in that region that have been observed using X-ray telescopes. So the clusters, they emit strong signal in the X-ray band due to the intracluster gas. And this region contains at least 5 that we know about, and probably more.
So have those superclusters been studied much in the optical or just in the X-ray?
So there are catalogues of superclusters that people have compiled from large redshift surveys. So things like the 2DF Galaxy Redshift Survey, I think they created a catalogue of superclusters by basically doing some analysis of their data. So they have been studied, but they're not particularly well understood, I have to say. They're not gravitationally bound, typically. They correspond to overdensities of maybe a factor of 10 in the universe, rather than a gravitationally bound object would typically have overdensities of 100.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 'cause they've only formed quite recently, I suppose.
Yes, that is the belief that they are in the process of forming. So the whole way that the universe is orientated, if we believe that objects like galaxies, they form to start with, and then they move together, as it were, into galaxy clusters, and then ultimately the galaxy clusters themselves form into superclusters, and sort of so-called hierarchical picture of structure formation.
Yep. So why are you interested in looking at lensing for these objects? Like, why is that something worth studying?
So the reason why we've instigated this survey is to, as I said earlier, radio weak lensing has not really been done before, or not to any great degree. It's a technique that's been used in optical waveband to look for dark matter and dark energy in the universe, because it's a technique that allows us to map the mass in the universe. It's not been done, as I said, in the radio band before, but ultimately the Square Kilometer Array, which is a telescope that's been built in Australia and South Africa, will allow us to do weak lensing surveys that are as deep and as accurate as can be done using the optical waveband. You need large numbers of galaxies in order to do this. But the reason why it's not being done before in the radio is that the source density is not particularly high. So this is in some sense a pioneering attempt to do this using the best instrument for doing this at the moment, which would be Merlin, because of its very high resolution. So it's not exactly what we would like to be doing. We'd like to be doing the SKA survey now, but that will have to wait for another sort of 10 years possibly before we can do that. But we're just trying to do a very small patch of the sky, as was done in the optical initially. Mm-hmm. People did about 1 square degree in the optical to start with. Now they're up to maybe doing 100 square degrees. And ultimately we would like to do thousands of square degrees using the SKA.
So it's kind of like a proof of concept.
It's a proof of concept, basically. Mm-hmm. And into the bargain, we'll learn how to do this technique, and we'll also find, as I say, 5,000 to 10,000 radio galaxies over such a large area, and that will allow us to actually understand things about the actual properties of those galaxies as well as doing this radio weak lensing measurement.
Mm. So as well as the fact that we're going to have the Square Kilometer Array, so we're going to have the kind of equipment there, what does radio lensing offer over optical lensing?
So the whole purpose of making a lensing measurement is to measure the shape of galaxies. That's what it basically comes down to. Mm. And the problem with doing that the positive side of doing that in the optical is that there are many galaxies that one can observe using the kind of telescopes that we have at the moment. I mean, you can get down to depths of maybe 10 per square arc minute on the sky. So that's the reason why you would do it in the optical. But the problem is that optical observations are, the resolution is dictated by the atmospheric fluctuations. And, well, people have worked very hard to make it work, and it does seem to be working, but there's always this residual uncertainty that's associated with the atmospheric measurements. In the radio observations, I mean, the fact that we can do radio observations from sea level in Cheshire at Jodrell Bank means that it is very much less affected by the atmosphere, and therefore we will have a better idea of what we call the beam, or the point spread function of the telescope, which is the optical response of the telescope, and it will now allow us in principle to make a better measurement of the shape of these galaxies, or one that's systematically better. Well, that's what the hope is anyway. As well as that, there are some other ideas that we might be able to use other aspects of the measurement of the galaxies, like the polarization of the galaxies, to actually improve our understanding of weak lensing.
So what do you mean by that, sorry?
So polarization is all light is light, and electromagnetic radiation is polarized, and remarkably, the polarization angle of a galaxy is often very strongly related to its elongation, the shape of elongation. Okay. What weak lensing involves is actually using the measured shape and the expected initial shape to measure how much the light has been deflected from its emission to where we measure it today. And that will mean that by using the polarization, we have some handle on what the shape of the galaxy was when it was emitted.
So it helps you to constrain better kind of the problem of intrinsic alignments, that all
that,
those
that's correct, yeah.
Could
so,
already be
yeah.
preferentially
that,
along
that, that is the basic idea. So there's a slight worry that the galaxies are already preferentially aligned when things start off. And that is a big systematic, potential systematic error in doing high precision weak lensing measurements. So the idea is to try and improve our measurement of that using this new idea.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that those are the two main reasons for doing it in the radio.
So given all that, how far along is the project now? What kind of stage are you at?
So we have measured, we've taken about one quarter of the data. So the mm-hmm. total allocation of time is just over 800 hours, which is, if you work it out, 40 days and 40 nights of observations. So it's a extremely large amount of observing time. And we've taken about one quarter of that, so about mm-hmm. 200 hours, and that's been analysed already. And we're at the in the process of trying to measure the shapes of those galaxies and trying to just check that the telescope's working properly and that everything's how we would like it to be. I believe, in fact, that some more observations were done last week and are actually possibly going on even this week.
Okay. So do you know if any unexpected challenges have come up in so far, or has it been going quite smoothly?
Initially, the Emerlin telescope needed mm-hmm. to be commissioned, and so when it first came online, there were various teething problems that needed to be sorted out.
Mm-hmm.
So we believe that those have been sorted out to a high degree, and we feel comfortable with using up most of the time on observations. We believe that all those teething problems have been sorted out. And I mean, I dare say that when we actually get to the data and we start looking at the real nitty-gritty of it, the very mm-hmm. high precision that we need to make these measurements, we will find that there are some issues that we hadn't envisaged, but we're reasonably confident that we'll be able to deal with whatever.
I mean, that's the whole point of doing this, I suppose. Yes, to find
indeed.
These issues.
Yeah. Indeed. So we will be learning as we go along. We'll be learning about what the problems potentially are.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the principle, I think everyone accepts that radio measurements should be less affected by the mm-hmm. atmosphere than the optical measurements, but there could easily be other problems of which we haven't envisaged. So that's part of the reason why we're doing this.
Mm-hmm. No, well, that sounds really good. So good luck for the rest of the project anyway.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And that interview was actually done by Monique in preparation for an article in a journal called Astronomy and Geophysics, which we're helping out with. And
I'm in that.
Oh, really?
I'm in that. I'm so excited.
What's your role?
Well, they're putting in some nice pictures of my nova.
Is this for the eMerlin edition when that comes out?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And they were all like, oh, we need a cover picture. We need a cover picture. And I was like, use mine. But they didn't. They said it was too boring. And they said, no one wants to just look at a blob. But it's not just a blob. It's a blob with direction and acceleration. I know that's hard to communicate in a picture, but I think
it's prettier than the pictures that I usually produce. So. But our very own Megan Argo is writing the article.
She's doing so much work.
Yeah. And me and Therese helped look for information for her. Somewhat successfully.
Anyway.
Yeah. Sometimes hard to contact academics in other countries. They're all very busy people.
Mm. Anyway, thanks for that, Monique. Now Max interviews Dr. Evaskun Himinasara about astrochemistry, massive star formation in infrared dark clouds, and prebiotic chemistry.
Hello, I'm Max Potter, and I'm joined by Dr. Evaskun Himinasara, who's from UCL, and she's talking about astrochemistry. I've just been to a really interesting talk that went from very dense astrophysical topics to some sort of very exciting, almost sci-fi stuff, so we'll get onto that a bit later. Yeah, so say hello, Evaskun, and tell us a little bit about yourself and what got you interested in astrochemistry.
Hello, hello to everyone. So it's really a pleasure to be here. So why did I become interested in astrochemistry? Well, so this was when I finished my undergrad studies, and then I started looking around for a PhD projects, and then I got in contact with who was going to be my PhD supervisor back in Madrid, in Spain, and then he told me all these exciting things about star forming regions and how molecules can actually tell you a lot of information about them. And then I was also attracted by radio telescopes. So if you have seen, for example, the film Contact, right? So that's one of the main interferometers, radio interferometers that we have. And I was always, you know, very interested in trying to do or trying to use that kind of instrument or that kind of instrumentation facilities. So I thought it was like a great thing to do.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah, that's when I started.
I think Contact was one of the films that inspired me to be interested in physics as well, actually. That's a real blast from the past.
Yeah.
So astrochemistry, I mean, when you think of chemistry, you sort of think of Bunsen burners and flasks in the lab. But astronomy is very different to that. So how do you bring the two together?
So basically, I mean, when you look at, you know, that our galaxy, so, and then all the space in between stars. So it's basically filled with gas and with particles, very small particles of dust. So actually dust and that gas, so those are key for these chemical reactions to occur. So when we talk about chemistry in the interstellar medium, so we are basically talking about gas phase chemistry. Okay. So we basically have like a volume of gas in which these molecules, like very simple molecules generally, like for example carbon monoxide, so one atom, one carbon atom joined one oxygen atom, and then we also have molecular hydrogen as well, so those are the most abundant molecules in the interstellar medium. So basically what we do is we try to understand all those gas phase reactions, and depending on the physical conditions, on the density or on the temperature that there is in particular regions of the interstellar medium, then there are some reactions that are more favorable, or there are others that lead to the destruction of some molecules. So basically by trying to understand what molecules we find, so we can track back what physical processes, or whether there was high temperatures, or whether there was a radiation field, UV photon radiation field, or whether there were shock waves. So that's the kind of things that we try to understand, okay. We try to play with.
That's interesting. So you mentioned shock waves then. That's something that came up a few times in the talk. Mm-hmm. Could you tell us a little bit about what a shock wave is and why it's relevant to this sort of chemistry?
Yes. You can find shock waves in many different types of environments. So you can find shock waves in star forming regions. So when you form a solar type star, basically one of the processes when the star starts accreting gas, forming a circumstellar disk, then it needs to preserve angular momentum. And then the way to preserve angular momentum is by injecting material through the poles, or, you know, in the direction of the poles. And those, when it injects that material, then as it propagates away from the protostar, then that produces shock waves. Okay. So that's one of the regions where we can find shock waves. Another region is supernovae explosions. But in our case, so we do study chemistry in these star forming regions because that's where most of the molecular gas is present.
Right.
So, for example, what I talked about in the talk was about one particular molecule, silicon monoxide. And silicon is one of the main constituents of these small particles, dust grains. So if you see this molecule in the gas phase, that means that you have destroyed dust grains. And then you can say that because the dust grain has been destroyed, the only way to destroy it is by shock waves.
Okay.
So that's the way to track back.
So you sort of, by looking at the composition of these gases and these clouds, you can treat them as a kind of fingerprint or evidence
probes.
of what has happened before and the environment that they're in.
Exactly.
Right,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
And how exactly can you tell which chemicals you're looking at?
Well, because you use spectroscopy.
Okay.
so this also applies to atoms, but in molecules, every molecule has its, as you said, its fingerprints or its spectral properties. So every molecule, so especially these molecules that are in very cold environments, so the only way to release energy is by rotational transitions. So that's a photon that gets emitted, and that photon has a very low energy. And that's when you observe it at millimeter wavelengths, so what you find is a basically a molecular line. So it's a spectrum. So you have the spectrum of that molecule for what that particular frequency. But every molecule has a full spectrum across the millimeter part of the spectrum of the light. And then by looking at those particular frequencies, those particular lines, then you can know what molecule you're looking at.
Right, okay.
Did I explain it?
Yeah, no, that's great. So can I just check I understand? It's like if you've got a full spectrum of light, like the rainbow, mm-hmm. there might be bits of it that are brighter than others. And that's those specific bits represent a kind of, they look like a barcode, right? And that's kind of the fingerprint of the molecule in some way.
So the every molecule, so if you have a look at the, because this is not in the optical part of the spectrum,
right.
You know, so it's more in the millimeter part. So then what you find is that if you have a look at the spectrum, at that particular part of the spectrum, it would be like spikes.
Yeah.
The spikes across the spectrum.
Okay.
Because that corresponds to the photons being emitted by the molecule from every level, or from every level of energy, let's say.
Right.
So but it would be like spikes,
Yeah, that's great. Cool.
They do not change in frequency, though. That's why...
Right, that's the crucial thing. Yeah, right? They're always the same.
Exactly, they're always the same because it's something particular of that molecule.
For a specific molecule, yeah.
Yes.
And then you know that if you've got a similar pattern, but it's slightly different, then it's been redshifted or blue-shifted, depending
on... Exactly, yeah.
That you can build up a picture of how things are moving inside these clouds by looking at...
Exactly.
...that with spectroscopy. Yeah, yeah. Okay, brilliant. So that's how you do it. So what are you looking at with it? What sort of problems can you solve by using astrochemistry?
Okay, so by using astrochemistry, I mean, you can cover many different types of problems. The ones that I'm interested in are the ones involving the formation of the most massive stars in our galaxy. So for that, I typically observe very dark and very dense molecular clouds in our galaxy, and then you can look at them, for example, when you have a look at the Milky Way in a dark night, and then sometimes you can see that there are dark patches across the galactic plane. So those are very massive molecular clouds, and then you see those dark patches because dust is absorbing a lot of the light. So in order to detect those clouds, that's why we detect molecules, because they are in a different range of the spectrum. And we can also detect the emission of dust, but at other parts of the spectrum as well. So what I'm interested in is looking at these very dark clouds, and I observe all these different molecules to try to understand how they move, how these gases move inside them, and try to say something about how massive stars form, whether they form directly from by gravity, by having a massive core collapsing by gravity, basically falling onto itself, or whether instead you have very little seeds initially form stars, lower mass stars, and then they start accreting, or they start gathering mass from the surrounding core, and lead to more massive stars in the end.
Okay, brilliant. That's really interesting. So you mentioned there briefly that there were sort of competing theories about how these massive stars form, and they form in these regions, these sort of molecular clouds. Which we can get very nice pictures of, actually, before I talk about that. There was the Nessie Nebula that you showed in the presentation. I thought that was a really nice really nice picture. You should definitely look that one up if you're listening. Is there a reason why it's called the Nessie Nebula?
I think it's because it's, it's like very wavy.
Right, okay. Fair enough. So that's even more sci-fi than the stuff we'll talk about.
Yeah, I didn't put the name. I think some people like to put them, you know, to give them names. I prefer to go to the technical.
Right, okay. So, yeah.
There's another one called the Dragoon, the Dragon, or the Dragon Nebula.
The Dragon Nebula, Yeah, I've seen the Horsehead Nebula is the famous one, isn't it?
Yes.
Dragon Nebula is a much cooler name.
Yeah.
So, in star-forming regions in these molecular gas clouds, there are competing theories about how these massive stars could be made at the same time as making the sort of normal-sized stars. How does that happen, and what competing theories are there, and how can astrochemistry be used to discern between the two?
Okay, so the current theories for the formation of these of the most massive stars, so there are two of them. The first one is the one in which gravity really takes the main role, So basically we have a very massive core and then that collapses, so that basically gravity makes it fall onto itself, and then we form this very massive protostar inside. Then there's another theory in which, so we first form these small seeds all across the core, and then the ones that are located right at the center, so because they are at the center of what we call the potential well, so it's basically they are at the center, so gravity is exactly saying the same mechanism as gravity, and then that makes those little seeds start accreting gas or gathering gas from the surrounding environment so they can grow later on. So what we've been trying to do is we've been observing these big cores, these massive cores, by using interferometers such as the submillimeter array and the Atacama Large Millimeter Array. So what we've been trying to understand is how these cores fragment, because one key point is to determine whether we see those little seeds or whether we don't see anything. Okay, right. And then for that, we use the emission, especially from dust. So when we go with interferometers and then we see like blobs, basically when you get an image from an interferometer, they are like blobs. And they may be like bright blobs, or they might be small blobs,
right, okay.
More diffuse. Those blobs are important because they actually have a lot of information, provide a lot of information. So whether they are, very faint or diffuse, or they have like an extended structure, or whether they are compact. So what we are finding is something in between the two theories. So we are not finding these very massive cores inside, but we are not finding either this population of small seeds. So okay. What we are proposing is these massive cores, so they start showing some small seeds in the center. Those are seeds start accreting gas, they become more massive, and then the other seeds that will lead to the formation of low-mass protostars will appear later on.
Okay, and how does astrochemistry justify the difference between
the difference between, because with molecules, so we can give information about the time evolution. So at the beginning, so we basically observe the molecular content in all these different types of cores at different stages of evolution. So the ones that show very little structure at the beginning, so we don't see any molecules. Okay. So which means that there's no protostar having any activity or in affecting very little chemically, from a chemical point of view, the environment. Then when the protostar, the seed, starts accreting gas, then the protostar forms. And then once the protostar forms, that heats up the surrounding environment. And then you start seeing molecules.
Right. Okay.
So then the molecules are key for establishing a world evolutionary stage in the core.
That's interesting. So in physics, you often, when you've got a filamentation process, mm-hmm. What happens is a sort of cascade of filamentation versus merging of filaments. Uh-huh. And what I mean by that is you've got, let's say you've got a large scale blob of gas,
uh-huh.
and it is, diffuse, and it's splitting up into smaller, denser blobs of gas.
Mm-hmm.
Those themselves can split up into smaller, denser balls of gas, which can go on to form stars. Or they could merge together and form bigger stars. Is it a competition between the two scales? Because that would be similar to other physics that I'm familiar with personally.
Mm-hmm.
Or is it something different? Am I on the wrong tracks?
No, indeed. So for some of the cores that we are observing, so if we observe them with interferometers at even higher angular, so with higher angular resolution, which means that we observe it, with finer. The images are even finer and finer, basically. Do you
right.
say that? The finer
yeah, yeah.
and finer?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So in some cases, we see that when, an initially relatively massive core was observed with one particular resolution, then it splits up in different condensations.
Yeah.
So that really happens. So that's actually the general trend. However, there are other cases in which you do observe that those cores do not split.
Right.
So you definitely form, massive, those massive cores. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, that's really cool. I think it's probably time to move on to the really exciting stuff, which is this prebiotic chemistry. Now, when I was researching before this, I had a look at what prebiotic chemistry actually meant, the specific definition of it. And I was worried because it looks like it can be a bit, it just means before life,
uh-huh.
right? but we are actually talking about the origin of life, that which is really exciting. So could you talk a little bit about your recent studies into that and why you got interested in it and what it could all mean?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I've been always interested, you know, because basically as astrochemist, the ultimate goal of astrochemistry is to try to understand how you move from a very simple chemistry in the interstellar medium to actually the origin of life. So an astrochemist, so that's basically what everyone would love to do. I am currently, or what we are currently doing at UCL, so is to try to see how from those very small molecules we could form in the interstellar medium prebiotic species such as amino acids. So, and in particular, we are working on one particular amino acid, which is glycine, because this is the simplest one that we know of. Also, this is not science fiction, because glycine has been detected in meteorites. So, you know, when the composition of meteorites has been analyzed in the lab, so people have found over 70 amino acids. And one of the most abundant ones is glycine, and the second one, alanine, or the other way around. So I'm not sure. I think it's alanine the most abundant, and then the second one is
right,
glycine.
Right, okay.
Also, you know, there's some work or some results provided by the Stardust mission or in the Vilt 2 comet. And then they also proposed that they had detected glycine. So you see, so glycine, you know, it has been like a very interesting target for astrochemists, like for a long while, for 10 years. The problem is that it is very difficult to detect in star forming regions. So we had, when it has been searched for, especially towards the molecular clouds around the galactic center, because this, so the galactic center is a very turbulent region. It's very rich from the chemical point of view. There are lots of molecules. There's actually a lot of ethanol, which, as you know, so is one of the main constituents of alcoholic drinks.
Right.
So the galactic center is full of ethanol.
Okay, great. Sounds like a great place to party.
Actually, so one of my friends calculated that the amount of ethanol in the galactic center could actually give enough beer for 3 Oktoberfests. You see? So it's a lot. It's a lot of.
Brilliant.
It's a lot of alcohol.
That's impressive.
It's impressive.
So what you're really saying is that Oktoberfest people consume an astronomical amount of alcohol.
Yes, right. Okay. Yeah, that's definitely the, I've seen it. Yes.
Brilliant.
So anyway, so whatever my point was, that so, you know, when people in the past have tried to look at this region, this region is very complicated, very, you know, when you look, do you remember that before we were saying that in this spectrum, you know, in the spectra towards these regions where we saw spikes?
Yes.
Imagine like millions of spikes all joined together. So if you try to find, you know, the right spike for your molecule, then it's going to be very challenging.
Right, because it's so close to the other ones that are nearby in the spectrum.
Exactly.
Right.
So then what we are trying now to do is to see whether we can detect glycine, but in simpler objects. And in particular, we are targeting what we call the precursors of solar systems. So regions that we know that they are going to be forming solar-type systems, or the systems like our own. So for that we are doing, we've been doing some theoretical modeling, and then in the future we will be doing some observations. So we are trying to see first, you know, what parts of the spectrum of light we should be targeting.
Okay.
Because glycine is more likely to be detected in one region and not in the others. And then second, we are trying to see what other molecules may lead to the formation of glycine. So what are the precursors of this amino acid.
Right. Okay, that's really great. So you mentioned in the talk one example of this sort of study, which was L1544, a pre-stellar core.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell me what a pre-stellar core is and why this one in particular was so exciting?
Yes. So a pre-stellar core, as I said before, so it's like the initial conditions of solar systems.
Yeah.
And then it's basically a dense and cold condensation. And we know that that condensation is gravitationally collapsing. So gravity is acting on it and is falling onto itself. So there's no protostar inside. So that's why it's cold. And that's why we call it pre-stellar.
Right.
Because it's before a star has been formed. Then we decided to take this one in particular because it has been studied very well in the past. So we have the information about the distribution of the density, of the temperature, and you know that for chemistry that's very important because those are actually the key parameters to understand the chemistry. And then we also decided to take this one because it's very peculiar from the point of view that we detected water vapor in this crystallized core.
Right.
So this was the first detection towards this kind of object, and that was reported in like two, three years ago by using the Herschel satellite. I have to say that water observations are very challenging from the surface. So you need to go to space to actually measure water.
Right. Is that because we've got so much in our atmosphere that it
just gets
annoying?
Blocks. Yeah, it blocks all the emission coming from water.
Right.
So yes, so then we detected water vapor. And why is this important? So this is important because, so as I said before, dust grains play an important role in the chemistry of the interstellar medium. So dust grains are very small dust particles, so like the ones that we have here in the Earth, but they are smaller. And then these dust particles, so they are surrounded by ices. And then the main constituent of these ices is water. So if we see water in the gas phase, so this water vapor, that means that a small fraction of those ices have come off, so they have been injected into the gas phase. And those ices are actually a little bit dirty, so in the sense that they have impurities. So they have other types of molecules, other types of stuff. And then among that stuff, there are these complex organics.
Right.
So because we know that there's water vapor, we are also sure that there are going to be complex organic molecules, and then we hope that among those complex organics, we can find glycine.
Right. Okay, brilliant. So but what is it about glycine in particular? Like, it's an amino acid, and it's the simplest amino acid.
Mm-hmm.
But why is that would that be such an exciting discovery to find glycine?
I mean, glycine, you know, that is a key molecule for the synthesis of proteins.
Right.
And basically we are targeting glycine, as you said, because it's the simplest one. And that means, do you remember that before we said that every molecule has its spectrum and has its spikes, no, in the part of the spectrum?
Yeah.
So the larger the molecule, the more populated is going to be that spectrum. So the more spikes are going to be. Or you're going to find. So if you target the simplest one, then it's going to be, you know, the one with less spikes, and it's going to be easier to detect.
Right.
So that's why.
Okay, so it's an easy detection.
It's easier to detect.
Yeah. But it could mean that there are more complex proteins being synthesized.
Exactly. Or at least, you know, that we will be able to say that so it is possible to synthesize glycine, so the simplest amino acid, so it's likely that you can do also the same for the larger ones.
Right. Fantastic.
Because you also find it in meteorites, so somehow, you know, they must come, you know, from somewhere.
So that was what I was going to ask next, actually, is we usually hear about what could have possibly seeded life on Earth. Was it an impact with a meteorite, or could comets have brought it to our solar system? So is this field related to that? Are the findings that you've got comparable to theirs?
Yeah, exactly. So the idea is basically, so the idea is to try to understand the chemistry at all these different stages. So we are probing the initial stages of the solar system, but indeed, so we need to compare, you know, the chemical composition of all these, how those organics are transferred from the gas to then to solid bodies, so to meteorites, comets, and then ideally how those solid bodies entered, you know, or went through the Earth's atmosphere and then impacted onto the surface and were released.
Right.
So that's basically the theory or the scenario that we are playing with at the moment. But we need to do it bits by bits.
Right.
To try to join everything together, all the information together.
Very long time scales as well to join together. So, which is something that was raised at the end of the talk that we just had. You know, complex organics, these proteins and amino acids, they didn't exist right from the start of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
So although glycine is the simplest one,
mm-hmm.
it's not the simplest thing that could exist. So how were these complex organic molecules made originally? And roughly, how long do you reckon they've been around for?
Okay, so then we know that these complex organics, so in order to exist, so we need to have these very tiny dust particles. Okay, so then as you know, then dust is formed very early in the universe. No, so now there are theories saying that you could form large amounts or significant amounts of dust in supernovae explosions. So once you have dust, that means that all the chemistry starts appearing.
Okay.
Because you can start forming water, and then you can start forming, you know, once you have oxygen, carbon, in the gas phase, in atoms, in the gas phase, then those stick on the surface of, these dust particles, they start reacting, and then you form all these, complex organics. So what we currently know, with, thanks to the Atacama Large Millimeter Array, is that we see water vapor, in galaxies, at redshifts, up to 6.
Okay.
So which means that if you see water, you probably have other complex organics.
Right.
In that. The problem is to detect them because they are very difficult to detect.
So what do you think this means for, you know, little green men? What sort of alien civilizations and things, what can this tell us about the origins of life in the universe, not necessarily just us?
Well, I think it's... I think it's important from our point of view. So we are first interested in knowing whether these prebiotic molecules can be formed in our galaxy, because that would mean that, you know, if you form these amino acids, then that would be a natural way of explaining the origin of life on Earth. Then, what I do believe is that if you have that, do you remember that we were talking about the formation of water very early in the universe, and then that probably has related some chemistry. So I do believe that, you know, it's like the universe was meant to make this chemistry, or to evolve into this very complex chemistry. And so, you know, the implications for this, for green men, that I don't know.
Yeah, so that's really exciting to think about. So I think the final question is, what is the most exciting thing about working in your field? What do you find, what's the coolest thing about your job?
I think probably, you know, all this work about trying to detect amino acids and trying to understand how chemistry can become so complex in the ISM, how that is transferred into solid bodies and then later on onto planets. I think that's going to be a big thing in the future, especially when we start exploring, you know, other planets farther away from us. So we can say something about the composition of their atmospheres, or whether, you know, there's biological content within them. I think that's going to be very exciting. But we will probably have to wait a little bit for that.
Just a little bit.
Just a little bit.
Oh, that's brilliant. Well, thank you very much for your time. It's been a pleasure having you on the podcast.
No, thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for that.
And now we've got some things to mention before we move on with the show. We're about to do a listener survey. So we've met some of our listeners now, thanks to Geocast Live, and that was really awesome. But unfortunately, we couldn't meet everyone because we could only accept around 50 people to come watch. But we'd like to hear some more from everyone about what they think of the Geocast, about how they think it's doing, whether they approve, whether they think things can be changed, whether you think we're dragging on too long now, whether you think that we don't go on for long enough.
What
kind of
your
thing.
Back details are.
Yeah, yeah, your social security number, all of
just
that.
Just all those things, yeah. Any relevant information.
You can
really.
Trust us with we're scientists.
Exactly, we need it for our data.
Yeah, big data, that's the buzzword these days,
exactly,
isn't it?
Big data,
but no, all we really want to know is how we can improve the Geocast. So while preparing for Geocast Live, I was listening through some of the back episodes, because not many of the people on the staff have listened to episodes since the beginning. I haven't listened to all of them.
I have not listened to them.
What are you talking about? Of course I've watched all, like...
Watched? Oh, you couldn't watch them.
I mean, listened.
There are only a few. There are only a few video episodes, so that is a feasible thing.
Oh, Lord, no.
But I've listened to a few from the past, and they have been changing. And I know some of the listeners have been listening since the very beginning, so they might have some ideas for things that we might want to bring back, possibly, if they could direct us to that.
Oh, that seems like that a really good idea.
Because sadly, such is the nature of academic life. Yeah. We move away and then other people take control.
So transient.
And stuff just gets lost. So that'd be really cool.
No, I think that's wonderful.
It'd be good to get some direction. So yeah, we're going to put that on our website. Take a look.
Please approve of us. We really want your approval.
So On Wednesday, the 20th of April, there'll be a pint of science with Mike Fold, who is a British-American astronaut and physicist.
Ooh.
Yep. So,
so he's four things.
Many, many things, yes.
And so what's he doing? It's a pint of science. So
it's
that's
a pint of science.
It's a thing. The pint of science is where you go into a pub and you have some pints and other people come in also and have
learn
pints.
Some science.
And learn some science. You sit there with your pint and you talk about science, I think. I've never done it. I know my supervisor is involved.
So it's a chance to interact face-to-face with brilliant scientists.
Yeah.
And pints.
And actually, from my experience, astronauts are the most eloquent of speakers. So
I spoke to an astronaut once. It was so cool.
Yeah. I imagine seeing something that almost nobody else on the in the world has seen is...
It must be mind-blowing. It must be really, really weird to come back here and just be like, literally, I am one of only a handful of people who's ever seen that.
It must give you a completely different perspective on just life and just all the different problems that exist.
Yeah. I'd love to hear about it firsthand, yeah.
Yeah.
Especially over a pint, because
yeah.
that gets you more
I'm
chatty.
Kind of convincing myself to go to this now.
So when's that again?
That's on Wednesday, the 20th of April.
I'm sure that some of the Jogcast people will be there.
Yeah. And if you want to know like actual relevant details, like where it's on and what time it's on and stuff, you can go to their website.
We'll put that on our website.
On our website.
Yeah.
Finally, the last event we have to talk about is the full Manchester Festival, which is taking place from the 23rd to the 25th of May. And tickets are on sale on Monday, the 18th of April. Speakers at this festival include Tim O'Brien, Sarah Bridle and Mitch McElijah. All those people are really cool. You should definitely come and hear them speak.
One of them's your supervisor. Is that why you said that?
Yeah, I have to say that. Yeah. Tim O'Brien's my supervisor and he's very good at speaking.
You
should go listen to him speaking. He's got a very impressive beard as well. And I think Mitch also has a beard.
Yeah.
No, wait, no, he doesn't.
It's shaved recently.
Is it? Oh, what a shame. Sarah has no beard, but she's still pretty cool. There's a Facebook page for it, which we'll link you to on our website. So now we come to part of our show where we talk about the random stuff that we couldn't fit in anywhere else. It's the odds and ends. And I guess I'm going first with my odd and end. For this show, I'm going to be talking about SpaceX's recent exciting development that happened last Friday. So as you may be aware, SpaceX have been trying for a long time now to land the launch bit of a rocket that goes into space. So a rocket, how that works, if you don't know, is there's a launchy bit that goes up and then that falls off and then the rest of it goes up into space and the launchy bit falls in the sea. But then they were like, that's a real waste of money and rockets. Mm-hmm. So they were like, wouldn't it be great if instead of falling in the sea, it could fall on a boat and instead of falling, it could land so that it doesn't explode. And it took them ages. It took them a really long time to get it to not explode.
This was try number how many? Five?
Yeah, five or six.
They almost got it a few times.
Yeah,
but it just kept exploding.
But then there's a really violent reaction to it if it goes slightly wrong.
Yeah, exactly. So like, there's some great videos of it landing and you're like, oh, and then it explodes. actually, that other crowd blew something blew. Jeff Bezos was in charge of it. They've actually managed to do it, but no one cares about them. So Elon Musk has succeeded in doing this, and it's really, really exciting. So I'm reading about it on the Ars Technica website here, and they have some really impressive footage of this rocket launching.
Yeah, I've seen the video.
Yeah, and then it just comes back down, and it just lands on this barge. I mean, they couldn't land it, like, on the land, obviously.
They have it from multiple angles. They've got it.
Oh, do they?
They've got a GoPro attached to.
Oh wow, that's amazing! I haven't actually seen that. That's really, really cool.
So you can see that.
So it's a really good thing. It's a really good thing for space travel because what this means is that it dramatically reduces the cost of sending a rocket up into space in the first place.
You can reuse it. Yeah.
You can reuse this part of it. Now, back in like the 70s, they were talking about how they'd like to do this. I think NASA and some other people like that were saying, you know, that it would reduce the cost of launching a rocket from like $25 million down to $25 or something like that. Now that was a bit ambitious. It really ended up costing a bit more than that, but at the same here we go. NASA said in the 1970s the shuttle would slash the cost of delivering payloads into space to $25 a pound.
Yeah, I was going to say
not $25 a launch.
Yeah, if you could get that much rocket fuel for $25.
I know, yeah. I was like, that's impressive. Really weird. I was like, why were the scientists saying that? It's obviously stupid. Anyway, $25 a pound. It ended up costing closer to $25,000 a pound in this instance. But at the same time,
the shuttles ended up being more expensive, I think, than the older method of sending people up into space. So actually having the reusable shuttle ended up costing more money, I think.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it ended up being very expensive.
Mm. Blue Origin, they've done it. They've managed it with the new Shepard propulsion module already.
So it's a really exciting time.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It's just brilliant that companies are getting involved in it, right? Because that will drive innovation.
I do want to say that there has been some cooperation between SpaceX and NASA, that actually NASA have provided some of the funds to Elon Musk and to SpaceX for this project. So
SpaceX have been delivering to the International Space Station.
Exactly, yeah. No, it's this really nice kind of symbiotic relationship.
But even that's going to drive kind of competition and work in the thing, because people will compete then for NASA's cooperation or funding.
Yes,
because
whoever shows
they are the best at it.
Yeah. Now, I get all my Elon Musk news from my boyfriend, who's like the biggest Elon Musk fanboy in the world. Like, I mean, on my list is like George Clooney and, you know, other nice people like that. His list is just Elon Musk.
Well, he's done some impressive stuff.
Yeah, no, he's amazing. He's really, really cool. Anyway, that's enough about that rocket. Now Therese is going to talk to you about a different rocket.
Yes, so I'm going to talk about the recent press release that was with Stephen Hawking. They were talking about sending tiny, tiny little spaceships off to Alpha Centauri. Now, most of the headlines said, we are going to go to Alpha Centauri and look for aliens.
Mm.
Not exactly what the funding is for.
Unless if you can fit inside a Raspberry Pi.
No, so what... I mean, the headlines make it sound almost as if in 20 years we will send these space... We will have this fleet of tiny little spaceships and we will send them to Alpha Centauri and we will detect all of the wonderful things. But that's not it. That's not quite... what's actually happening. What they've actually done is they've funded research into the development of these tiny little spaceships. So the idea is that in 20 years, maybe they might have a prototype or they will work out whether or not it's feasible, as opposed to the idea that they've actually funded the mission. They funded the research.
And I'm guessing it will take a little bit longer than that to actually get there as well.
Yeah, so the idea is that the tiny little spaceships will travel, I think, at about 20% of the speed of light.
Which is about 1,000 times faster than what we've got already.
A whole lot faster, yeah. I think the idea is that they would get there within maybe like a generation or something like that. So it wouldn't... Because Alpha Centauri is our nearest... is the nearest star to us, so it's the one we... have the most chance of actually ever getting
and,
to.
And just to point out, with our current technology, it would take about 30,000 years for us to get anything out there.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be really good. So
the idea is that these tiny little spaceships, they'll be about the size, I think, of a chip in modern electronics. So they're quite small, very light, and they'll have...
like little space butterflies.
Mm-hmm. But they'll have a huge sail, solar sail, then, that they can fire a laser at.
Little space butterflies.
And then you will just use that to shoot them off. And because they're so little, it's not so...
And are they propelling the solar sail or something?
With lasers. Yeah, very fancy. But, I mean, the biggest issue seems to be how they'll actually... getting there, that all seems kind of sensible. We'll link to the website, which lists a bunch of the issues they foresee, a bunch of the things they think they'll need to overcome with their funding. So we'll link to that because it's very interesting. They're being very open source about the whole thing, which is cool. But... yeah, so the biggest issue, though, seems how... So you can... Let's say you get your fleet of tiny spaceships off to Alpha Centauri. There's going to be no way to slow them down, so they're going to go past it. That's fine. But while they're going past it, we're going to need them to send back any information they have.
Yeah, and that's a long way. But how many light years away is...
Four light years.
So it's very far away. So, I mean, you're going to have to... In order to send information, they're going to have to... point the teeny tiny little spaceships towards Earth. They're going to have to send a signal that's strong enough and directed enough that we will be able to pick it up. And
they're going
to have the Earth's a tiny little dot at that point.
It's going to be very difficult.
They're going to have to have enough power left.
The
at that
power
time
they're
to
looking
do that.
At using like a 1 watt laser, I think. So it's going to be quite. It's not going to be a very strong signal.
I think
this will be the major thing that they'll have to overcome.
I think it's really wonderful how space travel, we always associate it with things that are really big, you know, these big rockets, you know, it's huge, it's so, you know, big and strong. Mm-hmm. And that actually, once we open our minds to the fact that things can be tiny and small.
In a way, that's the way to go, right?
Yeah,
makes things cheaper.
It's
makes things faster.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Right, it's even cheaper, right, to get them up into, in just out of the Earth's orbit is cheaper.
Exactly.
So much,
it must be so easy.
It's so expensive to get heavy things up into space.
But, my master's supervisor, she used to tell this really good story. She used to work with Russians, and she talked about, you know, during the Cold War, the Russians talk about, oh, we're going to build, you know, the biggest skyscraper, and we're going to build the biggest boat, and we're going to build the biggest rocket, and we're going to build the biggest microchip.
Yeah, I can see how that defeats it. Well, if you've crammed more and more small circuitry onto
that. Yeah, no, I think they meant just physically big.
Mm. Big is impressive.
Big is good, yeah. No, but small is good too. Yeah. I think that's the new motto.
Both extremes, yeah. Well, obviously, for a first pass, something small like this would be good. You do eventually need to be able to send people there or
bigger robots. Well, yeah, but I mean, but in terms of doing science, it would be very interesting to get anything there and actually take direct
nearby
measurements. That would be very
You've got to make a start.
Oh, that will excite the next generation in a way that... Well, we were watching the Rosetta landing, for example.
Oh, that was
imagine
fabulous.
Sitting there watching the entry into it. Well,
yeah.
So there's a long sort of barrier. Solar system isn't a very defined line, but imagine sitting there waiting and seeing the first planet.
Yeah.
Well, because Voyager's left our solar system now, right? It's, well, debate apparent. Again, as you said, it's not a very definitive line as this is the solar system, this is not the solar system. But I think people generally are in agreement that it's... And whatever we have decided at the boundary, it's probably past it.
Things like Voyager and New Horizons are real examples of how these long-term projects are worth it, because people will still be interested and people will still be excited.
Oh, yeah. It's definite. But you see this with any mission in space is decades of planning. Even if it's just putting a telescope in orbit around the Earth, like, say, any of the X-ray telescopes, that's decades of planning. Mm. Like, the people who initiate those projects are near retirement by the time they, like...
Yeah.
Are actually launched.
It must take a lot of dedication to go into the beginning of a project like this and realise that you may not see it through to the end.
Definitely.
But thank goodness people do that.
People enjoy the benefits of it.
You get to reap the benefits. So let's hope we're still around when this technology comes into action. Then.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, yeah, well, they're hoping that the research is for 20 years is effectively how long they're budgeted for to do the research. So after that, if they have a working prototype, if they have a proof of concept... Then they might actually get funding to actually send off this fleet, which would be very exciting.
Fly, my pretties! Fly! Fly!
Space butterflies.
Is how that's probably going to go.
I hope so.
This is you directing your space butterflies off.
If I'm directing them, that's how it's going to go.
And I have decided to do a little bit of a different thing for my own end. So we recently got an email in from John Murrell. He sent us a link to a news article. And he said, I'm not sure if this is meant to be a real paper... or if it's an April Fool's joke. And then he goes on to explain what this BBC article was quoting. He was quoting a paper that actually came out in the archive, which is the sort of depository for new scientific journals, very close to April Fool's Day. So I did a little bit of searching, and it seems like this particular paper is actually, no, it's not an April Fool. It's a real paper. So that's exciting. That gave me an idea. So I have collected three different papers here. Two are April Fools from 2016, written by scientists, and the other is not an April Fool. I'm going to read you the titles. I want you to guess.
Is one of them going to be his?
One of them is this one, yeah.
Okay.
I want you to guess which the one that John sent in that isn't an April Fool is. So the titles are Astrology in the Era of Exoplanets, Pie in the Sky, and A Cloaking Device for Transiting Planets. They're all exciting titles.
Okay, well, the astrology one is definitely an
April Fool's joke. Astrology in the Era of Exoplanets, Pie in the Sky, and what, the cloaking?
Cloaking device for transiting planets.
Cloaking device for transiting planets. Oh. I mean...
The astrology one has to be an April Fool's joke,
anyway. Does it really?
Oh, it definitely has
to be. I mean, because we don't know the content of it, right? It could just be an intention-grabbing title.
I don't know much about astrology, but I did a little bit of looking to read up on this.
Uh-huh. Yes.
So if you want, we can discuss what all of these papers are, and then you can...
That would help. Would be useful.
Okay, so I didn't know much about astrology, so let's start with that one. But am I right in saying it relies on... the locations of celestial bodies to predict your futures.
Yes,
that's my understanding.
So, yeah,
I think,
whichever one is. So there's all these, you know, you have all the constellations, and the sun moves through the sky along the ecliptic throughout the year, and it passes through the different constellations, and your star sign is the constellation it was in, so it was passing through. So ironically, the only one that wouldn't be visible in the sky, is the one that influences you.
Okay, so the attitude of this paper was it really wouldn't be that scientific to ignore sort of things in the constellations that we're more recently discovering, right? For example, exoplanets. Mm-hmm. So this paper, it mapped all of the known exoplanets and calculated where they fell inside the constellations. And then it looks at correlations between the number of exoplanets discovered and the social trends at the time. Mm-hmm. And it also figured out, I think this is the crowning achievement of the paper in my opinion, but the largest share of the planets falls in the fire signs of Aries, Leo and Sagittarius, which is apparently associated with self-centeredness. And it cites that actually, with sociological studies, it shows that we are losing our empathy as a human race. We're becoming
really?
Less empathetic.
The exoplanets are soaking up the
they're hailing the age of the selfie.
So that was paper one.
Ooh. Okay, I mean, I'm not gonna lie, even though astrology is largely considered nonsense by astronomers.
I mean, you wore an astrology shirt to your
class
life.
I did wear an astrology shirt. I have a little soft spot for astrology, actually. I think it's nonsense, but it's kind of nice nonsense, you know.
Well, like, it's always fun to indulge in something you think is silly sometimes.
Well, exactly.
As long as, like...
Yeah,
as long as you're not mean about it.
Well, yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, it probably means nothing where the sun is at what time or whatever. But at the same time, there's nothing unscientific about saying this is where the sun was and this is where these planets were and this is what the world looked like at that time. There's nothing unscientific about writing that data down.
Yes, as long as you're not drawing conclusions that may be...
Yes. Well, yeah, that's true.
Yeah. I feel this paper missed an opportunity, though. Surely the most astrologically sensible thing to do would have been to wonder what the constellations are from these exoplanets. What if the Greeks lived on these exoplanets, what pictures would they have drawn?
Oh,
and in that case, which of those pictures were blocked on your birthday and how will they influence
alien
your
astronomy?
Life?
Oh my god.
Oh, well, there's my idea for a paper right there. If your PhD isn't going
to be
that
the
well.
Most yeah. Draw pictures in alien skies.
Doctor of Astrology.
okay, so that was paper one. Moving on to paper two, which do you want to hear about?
Cloaking.
Yeah, okay. So this paper talks about the transit method is the most commonly used method of detecting exoplanets nowadays. Mm-hmm. And that is when an exoplanet passes in front of its host star, the star is dimmed very slightly. Mm-hmm. And so you realize that there's a planet there. So this paper talks about advanced civilizations may be developing the capabilities to cloak their home planets and talks about how much it would cost for us to cloak our own home planet.
Yeah. Oh, we should do that.
So their idea...
What's the point of doing that if we're sending a fleet of spaceships to tell everyone where we are? We can't do both.
It's to confuse them. To confuse them.
We can't do both. We have to pick either we tell everyone where we are or we tell nobody where we are.
So yeah, maybe we have to pick and choose. But this, maybe these guys are in favour of hiding, maybe not. But they come to the conclusion that one of the best ways to cloak our planet would be to have an array of lasers. Mm-hmm. And whenever you pass in front of the star and you are between your star and, let's say, a satellite orbiting another planet that's looking directly at you, you fire your lasers off.
Well, wait, how would you know? How would you know?
They could be coming from any direction. We'd
so
have to be firing the lasers continuously.
This is the big assumption about this paper that I thought was the main error of it, is that they assume you know the location of the person watching you. And by that point, they probably
know
where you are.
They have to know where you are,
well.
Too. That's way past the ball. If we're going to be cloaking, you need to do it today. You need to do it continuously.
So we should be cloaking.
We should be.
Right now, we should be in all directions.
And to be fair, Arecibo, I think, has been telling everyone where we are every so often or something, hasn't it? Someone...
Yeah, we do so, broadcast.
I think we should start, a lobby group, Irish astrophysicists for cloaking.
So what we this really should be doing might change your minds about cloaking. I did a little bit of research. They quote the power of the lasers that you need in order to cloak your planet.
Right.
So there are different ways you can do it. You could cloak just the oxygen signals of the planet, and for that you would need a 160 kilowatt laser. You could cloak the optical signal of the planet. So the optical wavelength.
Right.
And for that, you would need a...
So just hold up now. By cloak, do we mean shine a laser in all directions that is as bright as the sun?
Okay.
As bright as the bit of the sun we're blocking.
Ah, right, okay.
Okay, let's do it this way,
We want to make sure that the amount of flux that is leaving the solar system is the same, whether
words,
or not the Earth is in between
it's
the
like
sun.
It's like camouflage.
Kind of, yeah. Like holding an inadequate leaf in front of your face.
Yes.
So anyway, to cloak the optical signals from the planet, you'd need a 30 megawatt laser. And to cloak all wavelengths, completely disguise yourselves, throw on the invisibility cloak, as it were, you need a 250 megawatt laser.
So what's the most powerful laser we have currently at the moment?
So actually, we've got some even more powerful lasers than that. So for example, the technique of inertial confinement, which is a technique to try and trigger nuclear fusion in atoms by firing really powerful lasers at them. They have lasers that are terawatts and more, but they only go off for billionths of a second at a time. Whereas these guys suggest that even if we knew where this observing spy in the sky was, we'd need to have our laser on for 10 hours a year.
Oh my God, so I did
some research. The average price that I found, I did more work than I was when I was looking for a contract for my house. The average price per kilowatt hour is 10 pence. Okay. So to cloak all oxygen signals, it would cost about £160 per hour. All optical signals, it would cost £30,000 per hour. And to cloak all wavelengths, it would be the low, low price of £250,000 per hour for a minimum of 10 hours a year if you knew what a telescope was.
If you knew where they were, yes. And if you didn't know where they were, then it would be that multiplied by the amount of hours in a year, which is lots.
I haven't done that calculation, but that's...
I just feel like it's a lot cheaper for us all to shut our eyes, and then if we can't see them, they can't see us.
maybe we should just send out "we are very scary" sounds over the television.
That might attract the bad.
I'm not sure. I don't know much about alien psychology, to be honest.
Yeah, well, maybe that's another paper that can be written.
I mean, for the price of not getting annihilated by a scary alien, not that expensive.
I also wonder whether having those lasers on all the time would be sort of adverse to the sort of the planet as
a whole. There is a point at which you can ignite the atmosphere. I don't remember what it is. I think you have to. XKCD did a what if.
Yeah, I remember that.
Mentioned this at one point.
Maybe we'll add that to the show notes.
So again, what I'm hearing here is an idea which is pretty out there, but some scientific research and some investigation that nonetheless is sound.
I would lean more towards this than the astrology one.
Yeah, so would I.
However, it's not a very useful paper considering it requires information we just don't have, and by the time we would have, it would be useless.
Okay, so shall we move on to the last paper?
Mm-hmm.
This is Pie in the Sky. And actually, this is a quite a funny example of the dangers of a posteriori statistics. Mm-hmm. So do you guys know what that is?
Say those words again.
A posteriori statistics.
A posteriori.
Deciding what stats... techniques you want to apply after you have the data?
So yeah, exactly. This is a technique that's becoming more and more popular as we have really big data and we have really rich data sets. For example, with WMAP and Planck, we collect all the data first and then we look for, well, statistical oddities, for example, afterwards.
So basically, like a good way of doing things.
It's asking, what oddities can I find with the data? But you've got to remember that by looking at a really rich data set, in many, many, many ways, many different ways.
You're going to see something.
You're going to, unlikely events are going to occur, and sometimes they might be silly. And it's about what's the best way to define what's silly and what's actually something that's interesting and something that might fit a theory. So, an example of this.
Sorry, go on.
We've got the WMAP satellite, which maps out the cosmic microwave background. And very quickly after they mapped it to this really high resolution, they saw the initials of Stephen Hawking written in a font. On the CMB. Yeah, exactly.
What?
So...
Was it Windings? Was that the font?
No. It was an S and an H.
In the sky.
In the sky. Obviously, the probability of seeing this in CMB is infinitesimal, right?
Mm.
That's really unlikely. But it's sort of silly as well. There's no scientific theory, really, that would reasonably suggest that Stephen Hawking's name should be imprinted on the cosmic microwave background.
Unless he's an alien.
Yeah.
And this microfleet is his way home.
Oh my god.
I'm just putting it out there.
Okay. So
oh my god.
We need to know when to take these anomalies that we see in big data seriously and when to take them as silly things. And actually, this is giving away that this one is an April Fool, but if you do take these anomalies seriously all the time, then you might end up with a paper whose conclusion is something like this. And their conclusion is, there is a remarkable correspondence between anomalies in the digits of pi and in the anomalies in the CMB. So there are links between how the digits of the irrational number pi, which goes on forever, and the CMB, the links there which they've discovered.
But you could find links between the digits and pi on anything you wanted.
This
they
is
go
like
on forever.
This is like
you
that website.
Find every book that's ever written.
This is like that website of the weird correlations.
Yeah.
Have you seen that one? It's like no. It's this. Oh my god, it's brilliant! It's like a website, and it's just it shows all these different plots of how things like ice cream consumption in the state of Idaho is correlated with, you know, death by couch.
yeah. Or also like the Flying Spaghetti Monster one of pirates. Lack of pirates is correlated with
global warming.
Mm.
Ah,
and
yes,
this is
yes.
Traditional eye patch are parrots.
Pirates. So yeah, complete with references to Douglas Adams and fake quotes by
wonderful.
Mark Twain.
Okay.
They have written this paper, and in my opinion, it's the crowning achievement of this paper is they've generated a word search. They've done a complicated, and I quote, a complicated transformation on the digits of pi, and they've created a word search for you to play with. And
these
it's in the paper.
These people sound like they have a lot of time in their hands.
Well, it was April Fool's.
Anyway,
so that, one's
so that one's
Fool's
definitely
one.
An April
the
Fool's.
The astrology one, I feel, would have to be. So that leaves... The laser one as
okay.
Serious.
Yeah.
I mean,
what about you, Fiona?
I just don't know. I mean, I know they're both a bit silly, but I also think there's nothing wrong with them as, you know, as scientific research. I mean, you don't say what conclusions they come to in the astrology.
Well, maybe if you read the papers themselves, you might come to a different opinion, because obviously they're written in very different language, and I think
true.
The astrology one is a pretty withering commentary on astrology.
Is it really? Okay.
Quite possibly.
Oh, well, in that case, okay, I'm with Trace.
That being said, the pie in the sky one is possibly the most useful one.
Actually,
because
yeah,
it actually demonstrates
that.
A really useful...
Ah, so you
it's
think
a learning. It's a learning paper.
You think I've told
away,
it a lie here.
You come away with something useful, as opposed to with the laser one, you come away with, well, that's not actually very useful.
Yeah,
you come away
so.
With this one going, I should be careful.
I mean, they're being funny and they're joking, but they're actually making a really good point.
They are,
yeah. No, it's... and the WMAP people actually make that point when they announce that they found that Stephen Hawking's initials. Also, in the digits of pi, Stephen Hawking's name was in that word search. It was his whole name as well. Stephen William Hawking.
But don't they say you can find every book that's ever written or will be written in the digits of pi because it goes on forever?
Mm. And there's a very interesting website that actually... has every book that's ever written and will ever be written, which I've
that
seen.
Is a brilliant website. Have you actually searched for things in that? Because
it's really good. I've read the book that it was based on as well. It's based on a short story by a guy called Borges, and it's really interesting to read. But okay, final decisions, guys, because we are dragging on a bit.
Lasers
is
the
not
one.
The April Fool.
Yeah.
Oh, are
okay.
We right?
I'm going to take that as final, and you're right.
Oh my god.
So yeah, John, this was a real paper, and. They make some good points. You can do this. It's just it would be expensive. And also they assume that you know where the alien
yes,
would be.
Yes, it's a long shot.
And
which
that
by
is,
then is...
I would say too late.
Too late. Well, so if it's an alien civilization that's not well advanced, there's no point in blocking yourself from them. If they are advanced, it's too late.
There we go. So that was a very different odd and ends.
Fun though. I like yes. it.
Variety is the spice of life.
You could add in an archive versus snarkive. part of the
that's a really good shout. Okay, we'll ask that in the survey. Shall
yes.
we add archive versus snarkive?
Oh, that's a really good idea. I would enjoy that.
Okay. And we will put all of those papers on our website, I think, so people can take a look if they want and see how they're written. Actually, the footnotes in the Pie in the Sky one can be quite funny. I'd recommend it.
So, moving on from those April Fool's jokes to some things which are definitely not April Fool's jokes and real facts, we have Anna Scaife answering your questions in Ask an Astronomer.
For this month's Ask an Astronomer, we are joined by Dr. Anna Scaife, who will be answering three listener-submitted questions. Our first question is from Christoph Kranbull. How do you deal with all the interference of electromagnetic waves around Jodrell Bank? I wonder every time I pass it in a car or on a train. Does it become worse over time? Will there come a point where it renders Jodrell Bank useless?
So this is a very important question, actually, as well as being a good question to ask, because radio interference is a constant problem for all radio astronomy observatories, and certainly Jodrell Bank does not have an easy time of it. As the person asking the question correctly points out, the train line goes right past the edge of the observatory, and the observatory is not that isolated. It sits close to a number of towns and really not that far from Manchester Airport. And in fact, the radar for Manchester Airport really limits a lot of the science we can do in that particular direction. Radar itself is whilst it cuts out a particular direction for us, it's a very clear signal. What's more difficult to deal with is the sort of the general hum of all of the background noise around Jodrell Bank. And this is noise that's produced by everything from your mobile phone to spark plugs and car engines. It's a big source of interference. Any kind of wireless technology, really anything electronic produces a signal. And the dish, the Lovell dish, is so large that it's sensitive enough to pick up pretty much anything. Now, Jodrell Bank's doesn't have a protected radio quiet zone around it, which is a disadvantage for us as radio astronomers. A lot of other radio astronomy observatories around the world have nationally protected radio quiet zones around them. If you take something like the Green Bank telescope in the US, the radio quiet zone around that is so severe that you can't bring in a non-diesel car within the observatory area. And that's because of the interference from the spark plugs in petrol cars. You also can't take a mobile phone onto site, and you can't do that at Jodrell either. But at Green Bank, you also can't take on an iPod, a digital camera, or any other kind of electronic equipment that you might carry on your person. At Jodrell Bank, we don't enforce quite such strict rules. We do ask people to turn off their mobile phones. As it tells you, when you go into the observatory at Jodrell, the Lovell's sensitive enough to pick up a mobile phone signal from Mars. So someone standing right next to the dish having a conversation is pretty loud for us. But obviously we want people to enjoy their experience at the observatory, and that means taking photos and, you know, not completely stripping themselves of all of their other electronic equipment. We do try to maintain a reasonably radio quiet environment, and that means that we examine all the planning applications that go in around the observatory. And in fact, the director of the observatory reads through every planning application, which is a huge job because you have to cover a very wide radius around the observatory. And we're not always successful if something is going to interfere with the telescope. There are planning proposals that get through that do cause us problems. And we have to develop a very sophisticated suite of cleaning tools, if you like, for our data. So we have to excise the radio frequency interference as often as we can. Sometimes we just can't do that, though, and it just saturates the signal, at which point we just lose the data. That means that every new source of interference erodes the science from Jodrell Bank a little bit more. So it's very difficult for us to find that balance between not trying to impose restrictions on the people who live in the area and still maintaining the kind of science that you expect to come out of a national facility, which is what Jodrell Bank is. It is the UK's only national radio facility, and it puts UK scientists in a very advantageous position when it comes to competing on the world stage. So it's very sad when we can't do that because of some particular problem in the RFI environment.
So this is really a veto for the Jodcast plans to launch a radio station.
You can have the radio station, you just can't have a transmitter.
Yeah. Our second question is from Paul Stevenson. He wants to know what the best way is for an amateur to get started with radio astronomy, and are there any books or courses you would recommend?
So radio astronomy, I think, is perhaps slightly less accessible than other forms of astronomy because it relies so heavily on an understanding of electromagnetism and signal processing. But there are definitely ways you can get involved. A good way to get started, I have to say, is to go and find your local ham radio club, and they'll induct you into the ways of electromagnetic waves and radio signals. The other thing to do is to come and visit us at Jodrell Bank. The Discovery Centre gives you an overview and an introduction into radio astronomy and radio astronomy in the UK particularly. If you want something a bit more technical and you want to delve into the details, then there are actually quite a few good texts on radio astronomy. Most of them entitled something pretty obvious like Radio Astronomy. The book by Burke and Graham Smith, which is called Radio Astronomy, is a very accessible entry point to radio astronomy. There's a very good book called Radio Telescopes, so slightly obvious title, by Rolfs, which is a very nice introduction to the technical details of radio astronomy. If you don't want to go out and buy a book, you don't have to. There's a very nice online course, which I particularly like and which I also recommend for my students, which is called Essential Radio Astronomy, which was written by Jim Condon at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory in the US. And to find that, just type Essential Radio Astronomy into Google. And it's a very detailed course that covers everything from astrophysical radio emission mechanisms to how a radio telescope works and how you can string radio telescopes together into interferometers. So that's a great introduction. if you really want to get into the details.
Our final question is another one from Christoph, who asks, what difference would putting a telescope on the dark side of the moon make? He's thinking in general, but also about spotting inbound asteroids that could threaten the Earth.
So I have to say, I don't know a lot about spotting asteroids, but I can say there would be advantages to putting a radio telescope on the far side of the moon from the perspective of receiving more receiving radio signals more in a more sensitive way, primarily because, one, you have no radio frequency interference, or a very limited amount of radio frequency interference on the far side of the moon. And secondly, for low radio frequencies, it's very good because it puts you outside the Earth's ionosphere, which is a big source of problems, if you like, for radio observing at low frequencies. The ionosphere causes refraction and attenuation of radio waves, and really below a frequency of about 10 to 30 megahertz, you're not going to get anything usable out of a radio telescope on the surface of the Earth. So putting a radio telescope on the far side of the moon, or in space generally, is very good for low-frequency radio astronomy. And there's lots of interesting science to do at those wavelengths. A lot of the early universe, what we call the dark ages of the universe, is observable in the radio if you can go down to those very low frequencies. But, as I say, from the surface of the Earth, it's not really possible. There have been some proposals to put radio telescopes in space. Nothing massively successful so far, but it's definitely a possibility.
Thank you very much, Dr. Scope. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for that, Anna. Okay, so now moving on to the feedback. Apart from the email about the April Fool's paper, we got no other feedback. We had no post. We had nothing on Facebook except for some likes and shares.
Sad face.
Yeah, we're very sad. Send us posts.
But it's a come down from lots of feedback after your cast.
Well, that's true. So. That's true. And look, we're looking up here at our lovely postcard wall, so really we're not doing
and too hopefully bad. With our survey, and I'm plugging this all the time, but we'll have a lot of feedback for that.
Yes, I'm excited about that. Okay, so just to remind you, because you've all forgotten, you can follow us, you can now find us on iTunes, so please rate us and review us on iTunes. We'd be really excited about that.
Thanks for all the likes and shares on Facebook.
And thanks for all the follows and retweets on Twitter.
And if you want to get in touch, you can also do so via the website at www.jodcast.net.
On Twitter at twitter.com/jodcast.
On Facebook at facebook.com/jodcast.
On YouTube at youtube.com/jodcast.
On Flickr at flickr.com/groups/jodcast.
And not yet on Instagram, because that's still not a thing.
And don't forget that you can send us posts. The address is on the website. And thanks to Avaskan Jimenez-Serra and Richard Batty for the interviews.
The editors were Charlie Walker, Ian Harrison, Niall McCallum and Ben Shaw.
The producer was Monique Henson.
And so, until next time...
Jod on!